Hey, podcast listeners, this is Kate Brown, and I am the newsroom assistant here at ProPublica. It has been quite a week, and the surprising outcome after a historic election were the results of the country casting their votes on November 8, 2016. Voting and access to the ballot is exactly what ProPublica and partners ambitiously covered in real time as it happened on Election Day. Election Land, a project launched by ProPublica, USA Today, Univision, the Google News Lab, and WNYC, built a staggering reporting network of over 1,000 journalists. This, along with newly created applications and innovative use of social media, made this real-time national reporting possible. Today, I have the good fortune to speak with three of the people who were at the center of it all. Scott Klein, Celeste Lecompte, and Jessica Hoosman take us step by step through the reporting process that is unique to Election Land. They also share what they found from doing the reporting. Some of the results might actually surprise you. We also talk about what large-scale collaborative projects like this could mean for the future of news and why this couldn't have been done before this year's election. Thank you so much for joining, and enjoy. To my left, I have Celeste Lecompte, who is Director of Business Development here at ProPublica. Hello, Celeste.
Hi, Kate.
Welcome. I have Jessica Hoosman as well, a senior reporting fellow here at ProPublica, who ended up being the face, more or less, of Election Land. Welcome, Jessica.
Oh, dear. Thank you.
And to my right, I have Scott Klein, who dreamt up this intrepid project. And welcome to you, Scott.
Thanks. Good to be here.
First, I want to talk about how this all came to be. How did this idea come to you, Scott? I know it was you who came to it first.
Yeah, I mean, it was me working with some others. I had occasion to have breakfast with an old friend of mine, Simon Rogers, who I first knew when he was at The Guardian and is now at Google, working at the Google News Lab. And we realized in talking that my department at ProPublica, which does our interactive journalism and our data journalism, and his department at Google, which does kind of interfaces with news organizations and does projects with news organizations around some Google data, that the two departments shared a mission, which was to try to help journalists everywhere do great journalism using data and using technology. And we said, well, what are the kinds of projects we might be able to do together? After all, there's a big election coming this year. This, by the way, was around May. And we kind of came up with a couple of projects, and we were talking, I'm not sure really kind of who came up with the idea first, but one of the things we thought we might be able to help America cover a bit better was voting problems on Election Day. So every newsroom in the country, except ProPublica, focuses really hard on election results, which is mm-hmm. obviously a really important question. Who is winning? Who won? That's a key question on Election Day. But not a lot of people are able to report out how is voting itself going? What are the impediments that are stopping people from being able to vote? And we kind of went back and forth a few times. We wrote a memo. We pitched it up to the rest of the folks at the Google News Lab. They very generously funded the project, and we started working on it. Came very clear early on that we were going to need a lot more people to help us figure it out. So in addition to the folks at the Google News Lab, we brought in WNYC Radio here in New York. We brought in some journalism schools, including CUNY Journalism School and Columbia Journalism School. We brought in an organization called First Draft, which is a social media news gathering organization, which I can talk about later. Mm-hmm. And we brought in Univision, the kind of large multi-billion dollar news organization that focuses on Hispanic folks here in America. And we brought in the USA Today Network.
Today, I was writing the post to go along with this, and Jessica corrected me. It was nearly 1,000 people involved in making this happen.
We ended up having 1,100 people.
Wow.
Working journalists working on Election Day, which made us, I think, one of the two or three biggest news organizations in the country for 18 hours.
Wow.
Now we're back to one of the smallest again.
But yeah.
for a time being, for a short time, we were one of the largest. And that broke down as there were 600 journalism school students. There were about 450.
About 400
local news organizations that were using the tips we generated to create stories. And there were about 100 professional journalists working out at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism newsroom here in Manhattan.
Yeah, that's what I got to see, which was the newsroom at the CUNY J School, and it was incredible. I think what can be a mystery sometimes is how reporting actually works, like what is actually involved with doing the reporting. So I would love to hear a little bit about like what the day was like and what the different moving parts were doing to make everything happen and report out what you did report out.
Yeah. So the students were busy little bees all day. That was pretty exciting. So we had 14 journalism schools all across the country that had been assigned specific regions. And so they were using these tools that our partners at First Draft Media had taught them how to use to find Facebook and Instagram and Twitter posts predominantly that they would then authenticate and make sure that the person who was tweeting them was a real person and that the photo that they tweeted wasn't like something that like came up in Russia 4 years ago, was an actual original photo, or that the video that they shot was where they said it was supposed to be, stuff like that. And so once we kind of had a good idea that the tweets or the Facebook posts were about real things, then they'd send those up to some journalists that we had in the newsroom, and they would put all those together, find patterns with that, and then also data we had from people who were texting us all day with the text line that we had set up for voting problems, and then also the election protection data. We had access to the lawyers' committee data on all of the calls that they'd received that day for problems that they were helping people sort out for voting. So they'd package all of those together and send them out as super comprehensive tips to these 400 or so local reporters. And so by the time it seems that they got to the local reporters, these reporters had really excellent starts to go off on. They like often had contact information for specific people that these things were happening to. At a minimum, they had an address of a polling place that they needed to immediately go to. So it made it a lot easier for them to report quickly on election day, which people usually can't do.
How did you all communicate? There's a lot of information being shared. What was used to do that?
We had a really active Slack community. There were about 800 people who were busy writing posts and reading posts and sharing tips on Election Day proper, and over 1,000 people in the days ahead of the election. By Election Day, some people were out in the field and were getting calls from their colleagues and calls from us and emails, but Slack was really where most of the action was happening.
Can you tell us what Slack is, Celeste, for those that don't know? It's a chat room.
It's
really
a chat room for your organization that you can break up into little pods for people who specifically focus on this or specifically focus on that. And so you can have little private communications within group chat stuff.
That obviously was very effective for you guys since you got all this done.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Jessica, would you mind taking us through the reporting process step by step? When a tweet comes in and then sort of what happens from there in getting the tip out?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that it's important to note that we were not waiting for tips to come to us. We were like actively looking for things. We sat down with a lot of smart people several weeks ago and determined like in these various languages, what words would people use if they were facing one of these 30,000 problems that they could possibly face and standing in line to vote? And so we had students all across the country preload those search terms into TweetDeck. And so they were just constantly monitoring for any mention of this and then pulling the ones that seemed like they could be problems. So let's pretend we have an example tweet here. So I've got a tweet and it says, like, I'm standing in a 4-hour long line in North Hollywood, California, which happened. We got those tweets. We get this tweet. We found it. We have it. The students would probably respond back to the person who had issued this tweet, say, hi, I'm from election land. Like, what precinct are you at? And then they would tell them the precinct. They would make sure that that person existed, right? There are some very specific tools that you can use to make sure that this is a real person and not a bot, that you can make sure that the photo of the line that they tweeted wasn't like a photo of like a Justin Bieber concert that happened 3 weeks ago. And so they would do all of those things. And then once they'd authenticated that this was like a real problem happening to a real person who actually was standing in a line in North Hollywood, California, they would throw it into a program called Check. And then from there, they would make notes in Check. Like, I talked to this person. Here's what they said. They said you could contact them. Here's their contact information. And so we then the catcher, the professional journalist who's sitting in our newsroom, would take that. And then they'd, if there were other tweets from that same precinct or we had a call from the election protection commission, they would take that as well and package it together and say, like, here we have four reports of these people standing in line. They say it's a four-hour wait to vote in North Hollywood, California. Like, we should go see what there is to see about that. And so we would send it. And in this case, we send it to our partners at the LA Times, who sent somebody out there. They actually already had somebody out there, so we were able to give them some people who were standing in that line that they could contact, that they were, that were willing to speak to media. And, you know, in that same line, we also had people, like, there were hundreds of people in this line. So there were hundreds of people tweeting about this and, like, calling in and complaining and texting us saying that they were waiting in this line. And so we could package all of that together, and we had a pretty comprehensive idea of what was going on, right? If you're waiting in line for 4 hours, there's a lot of stuff that can happen to you. Like, during, in this line, there was, like, people who came out to scream at other people. There was a woman who reported that she got her ballot ripped up, and we reported that as well to these local reporters.
All
in
the same line
in North Hollywood, California. And we were getting all of these tips, and we're sending them all to a reporter who had a far more comprehensive idea of what was going on with these people standing in this line in North Hollywood, California, than they would have if they just kind of, like, showed up and started walking around, right? Because we were able to kind of help them with the reporting process on the front end. And so that became a really interesting story out of the LA Times that was more comprehensive because we had these social media posts that they wouldn't have been aware of otherwise, probably.
We spoke last week on the podcast about what you guys expected to see and how things were going leading up to Election Day. And now we have these results. I know that we would all love to hear what was found from doing this reporting.
Well, it was
quite a bit.
I mean, we found a lot of stuff. But I think that at the end of the day, right, this was like a really bizarre campaign season, but it was a pretty humdrum Election Day, all things considered, right? At the end, like, you know, we had this candidate who was screaming about how rigged the election was. But at the end of the day, like, we have no evidence of that. We have no evidence that there was an organized campaign to intimidate voters, which a lot of people were afraid of and that people were actually talking about, right? Roger Stone was, in fact, creating, it seemed, an organized campaign to intimidate voters. That did not transpire. There's no evidence that that happened. There were isolated incidents of campaign, of, like, voter intimidation, certainly. And some of those were pretty sad. But it wasn't happening all over the country like people thought that it would be. And it wasn't even happening all over one metropolitan area like somebody like this, a lot of people thought it would be. Like, we didn't see an organized campaign in Philadelphia or any of the other cities that Trump mentioned would have it problems in certain areas.
Nor did we see large scale or any scale voter fraud. We didn't see anybody reporting, you know, other people voting twice or,
right,
you know, buses. There were stories about buses full of people going between polling places to vote several times. There was literally no evidence of that we saw, and we really were in a position to see everything.
I mean, not as far as I know, like a single tweet that we could authenticate that these things were happening. I mean, certainly there were claims, right? But we couldn't trace them back to any actual circumstances.
We had access to, through some agreements with other organizations and also just the same kind of access to social media that anyone has, we had access to data from an organization called the Election Protection Coalition, who run a nonpartisan, independent call center that anybody on Election Day can call into to report problems, and also during early voting can call into and talk about problems. So this is 866-OUR-VOTE, which is after Election Day. So I assume if you call, no one will answer. But on Election Day or during early vote, if you call 866-OUR-VOTE, you'll get an attorney or a paralegal who will help answer your questions and, if necessary, represent you in court or send you to an attorney who can. And so we had access through an agreement with them to all of their data, so we could see people calling in. We had access to social media, so Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and we had people who were dedicated to looking at those and filtering those and kind of finding only the things that are about the election and then authenticating whether the things were real, as we've said. We also had access to some Google search trends. So we actually had a table full of Google engineers, which was a remarkable thing to see, from like three or four different countries.
Oh, wow. It's the entire Google Trends team.
It was the entire Google Trends team who were not only did they build custom sort of tools and maps and visualizations of this data for the project, which were amazing, but they actually also were sending kind of into this stream of data that was going through the newsroom insights about Google search trends for specific problems. So provisional balloting, long lines, voter intimidation, things like that. They were kind of sending that into the stream so that if people were talking about a specific problem, they could go and kind of look for trends, search trends about that. Oh, we had about 130,000 people who had agreed to let us text them on election day to let us know how their vote was going. Did you text us?
I did.
Back? I got the text and then ignored it because I was so busy. But and besides, I had already voted. So and we had a lot of them responded. So we had lots and lots of people letting us know how that happened. We also had, for people who are more comfortable with it, we had WeChat for Chinese people, and we had WhatsApp for Latinos, especially who come from Latin America and are much more comfortable using WhatsApp for more secure communication. So we had a WhatsApp channel and a...
Wow. So it's a combination of, you know, existing tools and then stuff that we built, that the Google...
Yes.
This is, you know, insanely ambitious. And is this something that you could have seen maybe in 2008 being able to happen?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think that the tools that we use for communication, the tools that we are using to track social media, our ability to tap into these other data sets, to register to vote by text message, which one of our partners allowed, none of that was in place in 2008. So this was really the first election where I think any of this was even possible.
Yeah. And I was on Twitter in 2008, but it was a very different place.
Yes.
I just don't think social media was quite there. And also I think the idea, journalism has grown up as an industry about collaborating with each other. And I think one of the things that the Panama Papers taught us was that being very open about collaborating and being truly collaborative and not kind of competitive while you're being collaborative is a crucial part of this. So we had 400 journalists at something like 250 newsrooms who had to agree that all of this would be non-exclusive.
Right.
And that what they were seeing, you know, everyone else in their market was seeing. And they were all okay with that.
Right. It was really inspiring to see all of the partners together. We're still tallying up the final results, and we've already recorded more than 100 stories that appeared on air, in print, in broadcast related to this project, both in the days beforehand, helping provide advice to voters about problems that they might experience and how to avoid them, as well as on the day of and in the days after.
This not having been possible, very likely not possible until now. Is this, would you say, a model moving forward for reporting on things like this, for, you know, to lead to sustainability for news organizations as well as just doing more ambitious reporting?
But I think that it is. It does point in interesting directions for lots of things. First, the idea of large-scale collaborative journalism. So Panama Papers did it. When Panama Papers did it, it was also this sort of top-secret data set as well. So they kind of had problems we didn't have. So I think that the idea of large-scale collaborative journalism is now confirmed. So if Panama Papers was the first really large-scale example, this is the second. And the second is this thing called social media news gathering and verification. Turns out to be this incredibly powerful thing. We learned so much from the people at First Draft, Fergus Bell, Jenny Sargent, Claire Wardle, Tom Trewinnard, a bunch of people working with the First Draft Coalition, who are able to take social media hints and turn them into real reportorial leads, authenticating, you know, is this person who they say they are? Is this photo, this is the first time this photo, is this photo taken for this, you know, or was this something they got off the internet? The thing depicted in the photo, you know, is that a legitimate thing? There is a lot to it, and it is a discipline, and they're able to do some really incredible stuff. So I think it sort of proves out both of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the social media point's really interesting, particularly given a lot of the big upsets in polling in the last couple of elections, both here and with Brexit.
Right.
A lot of the after analysis has shown that social media was actually a better predictor of the outcomes in a lot of cases. And so learning to take social media seriously as a source, both as a large data set to be looked at from sort of a polling perspective, but also in the reports that people are making are in fact very valuable reporting information, really useful sources for telling stories for reporters is a sort of sea change that we're seeing happen right now.
I think that's exactly right. Using social media not as just a place to promote your story and tell your friends about your story, it's like as a journalist, right?
Yeah.
Not just to promote your story or even to just find a way to find sources for your story, which is another thing I think we've done a lot at ProPublica, and I think a lot of people are doing now, but to find the story itself, right? That the story is out there in social media waiting to be told.
Celeste, I think you had an example that you wanted to share.
In advance of the election, we were seeing a lot of concern that there were going to be voter intimidation problems all across Philadelphia. So throughout the day, it was something that we were looking for. One of the sources that we were looking at was data from the Election Protection Coalition, and those are more direct examples of people calling in with specific problems. So we were seeing a few reports here and there about people who were feeling intimidated or threatened or getting into arguments and things like that at the polls in Philadelphia or around the area. So we started looking into that. One of the data sets we were looking at was Google Trends, and we started to see a lot of search activity around voter intimidation keywords in the evening. So we started putting this together and thought, well, maybe this is actually happening. But as we got further into it and started really being able to mine through social media and look for reports of problems, able to send out multiple reporters in the Philadelphia area out into the field to the places where voters were reporting problems, we were able to discover that it actually seems like it was one-off confrontations where it was a couple of people in line at the same time who just sort of got into it, not a pattern of voter intimidation across the area, and that what we were seeing in the search spike was actually people who were wondering if this was happening. So being able to sort of put all that information together in one place and tell a real story about what was happening and sort of what curiosity was versus reality on the ground was a really interesting example of that. One thing that we haven't talked about is the things that we did find were not necessarily one-off reportable experiences. We saw large patterns of things like broken machines or problems with voting machines. The technology used in elections around the country is something that seems like there's a sort of pervasive challenge that's facing both this election and future elections, that we have to do something to update the technology that supports voting in America. And that was something that became very clear, but wasn't something that we could necessarily, like, send a reporter out into the field to fix a problem immediately. But it did definitely show us that, like, at a broad level, there are national issues around elections that we should be addressing in the next couple of years before the next midterms.
I echo that completely. And I think that we started the day looking for active voter suppression of the kind that was described in the campaign. We ended the day essentially, you know, without it, but still with the kind of problems with voting that we knew about when we first started reporting. Voter ID laws that confuse and perhaps suppress votes, lines that are so long for whatever reason that people are discouraged from voting. They don't have time. They have to go back to work. They can't wait in a two-hour line to vote. Those are still problems. Those still stop people from voting. We are still in a situation as we had in 2012 where 500,000 people didn't vote because the lines were so long they couldn't wait. Those are still problems. Whether we didn't have thugs running around with bats stopping people from voting or buses full of people going from polling place to vote multiple times, what we're left with is a voting system that needs help, technology that hasn't been updated since the Palm Pilot era, confusing laws, the Voting Rights Act having been changed radically by the Supreme Court in ways that we still don't quite understand. The animating principle behind Election Land the entire time has been that whatever the number is, losing your right to vote should never happen. If you are eligible to vote and you can't vote because of some bureaucratic problem or because of some machine problem or because of some other bad excuse, then you have lost a fundamental right, perhaps the fundamental right, and we ought to take it deadly seriously whenever it happens.
Were there any states or regions where you saw concentrated acute issues or concentrated issues of any kind?
Texas is demonstrative of so many problems that face elections, right? So in Texas, people vote in lots of different ways. In some counties, you can vote anywhere, right? In Travis County, which is where Austin is, you can vote anywhere you want. In Dallas County, you have to go to a specific precinct. Some places use electronic voting, some places do not. There is a ton of stuff going on in Texas on a very localized level. And then on top of that, you have an incredibly confusing law to the point where I have read that law, like I've literally sat down and read it. And like at one point made a flow chart of the law. in my planner because this is what I do.
Hand-drawn
flowchart with various colors. And it is still confusing to me how a poll worker would implement that in real time and how you would hold poll workers accountable for implementing that law. The law is very confusing. And the reason that it is so confusing is not because the law was written in a confusing way. The law was written in a very straightforward way. The problem was that it prevented a hell of a lot of people from voting. And so a federal court judge over the summer struck part of it down. And so very late in the game, right, when you've already trained poll workers, when you've already had signs printed for polling places, you're changing the law like in the weeks leading up to the election. And then nobody understands it. So you have poll workers who are implementing it inappropriately. And then on the flip side, you have poll workers that are implementing it appropriately, but the voters don't understand that that's what they're doing. And so they complain anyway. And so we had a lot of voters who called, like lots of voters who texted in or tweeted at us or called the election protection folks to say, well, the poll workers in Texas asked me for my ID and they can't do that anymore because it's against the law. It is, in fact, not against the law. The law in Texas says, and you just like bear with me because this is very confusing. The law in Texas says if you have one of these seven forms of ID, if you have it for up to 4 years expired, you must present it in order to vote, which means that they can, in fact, ask you for your ID and they can, in fact, walk the line and say, everybody get out your IDs. You need them to vote because you do if you have it. But if you get to the front of the line and you say, I don't have it, but I do have this non-photo ID form of ID and I have my voter registration card, then you can fill out an affidavit saying that you don't have an ID and here's why, and then you can vote, right? So we had lots of people calling us being like, oh, well, they're asking me for my ID. They can't do that, but they can. Or we had poll workers who were not allowing people at all to fill out this affidavit saying they didn't have an ID and they were making them fill out a provisional ballot instead, which is also against the law. So there was just mass confusion on all levels in Texas. And it is indicative of this, like, this completely changed mindset in the United States now, right? We don't have the Voting Rights Act to give preclearance to these crazy laws. They could have figured this out a long time ago if that were still the case. We have jurisdictions who are doing training in vastly different ways across the state of Texas. The state of Texas used to train poll workers in person. They do not anymore. Funding for that was cut. I think that everything that is wrong with voting can be found in Texas, which wow. I say but as a Texan.
Oh, ah,
but bigger.
But bigger.
One thing that, however you imagine elections work in the United States, there is no single federal election authority. So there is not one election that happens every 4 years. There are thousands. The framers wanted it this way. The founding fathers or whoever did not want the federal government to have too much power in elections. They left it in the hands of the states, and the states tend to leave it, though not always, but they tend to leave it in the hands of counties. So there are 3,000 counties in America, and there are probably that many ways of doing it. Counties are able to buy their own machines, decide their own rules. States pass the laws, but the counties have voting rules. They decide how the election day setups are, how the workers work, what the rules are around early voting, where the early voting sites are. There are thousands of different ways of doing it. There's an infinite number of combinations for the election.
I do also think that it's important to mention that this like very different voting systems from county to county is also like a silver lining is that it protects us from national rigging. Like one of the reasons that we knew that Donald Trump was full of it when he was like, oh, the national election's going to be rigged is because you physically cannot do that. Like you would have to be in cahoots with 3,000 different entities across the country, many of which are run by Republicans. So it's just like never going to happen. It's also this reason you can't hack the national election, right? Right. So like, you know.
It's not the World Series.
It's not. It's not. It is not. You can't like pay off one dude to like throw some balls in another direction.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I mean, it's a mess, but it's, you know, it's a mess you
it's
can't
our
make
mess.
Messier.
Yeah, it's true. And we love it.
And it's gotten much better. There is a federal agency that now encourages and provides grants for local jurisdictions to do elections. better by using technology and data. It is getting better. The data is better than it's ever been. One of the reasons we could do this is that things are getting better and clearer than they've ever been before. But I think there's still a lot of work to do.
I would love to hear if you're able to share what the future of election land is.
There's still plenty of stories coming. There is a story waiting for me to edit back at my desk. I think that you'll see lots more. We have a huge data set, an unprecedented data set of all of this stuff. We have it all still, so we can go back and do queries and look to see. One of the questions I have is, you know, we saw a ton of long lines, and we assumed during the day that a lot of those were because of record turnout, but it turns out that there was not record turnout. The turnout was actually quite low. Lots of reasons why that could be. It could be that there was record turnout in some places and record low turnout in other places, and we're just seeing some variation. There could be lots of other reasons as well, but we are looking into that right now using the data that we have. So we've got lots of stories that we can be doing and we will be doing through the end of the year.
Well, I want to congratulate you all. It was an honor and completely inspiring to see. Thank you for doing it too, because it's really important work. And thank you for joining me here in the ProPublica podcast studio.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you, guys.